of mass unrest linked with Islamophobia in France. The frequent incidents of blasphemy in France has led to mass unrest across Pakistan.
The European Union is putting pressure on Pakistan, and they want them to weigh and to see whether this decision of expelling the French ambassador from Pakistan, will the government of Pakistan, will the people of Pakistan pay the price? Are they ready?
European Union's concerns go much beyond possibly expelling French ambassador.
Prime Minister Khan has crossed the Rubicon. EU policy towards countries that enable Islamic extremism must be resolute. Withdraw Pakistan's GSP Plus status now.
In an official reaction, Islamabad expressed disappointment with the European Union, pointing out that it reflects a lack of understanding in the context of blasphemy and associated religious sensitivities in Pakistan and elsewhere in the Muslim world.
None of the convict of the blasphemy law was ever executed in Pakistan after successful governments and superior judiciary allegedly buckled under pressure to set convicts free and led them to migrate and settle in Europe. This has led to lynching of 75 under trial prisoners and suspects amid reports of misuse of blasphemy law in isolated cases since 1987 onwards. Javed Rana, Islamabad.
Every year on the 1st of May, protesters fill the streets of cities around the world, marching on what's known as May Day or International Labour Day. Demonstrators usually consist of various groups supporting a wide variety of causes. Yet this year in the UK, activists joined more than 40 protests throughout the country centred around one thing: opposition to the controversial Police Crime Sentencing and Courts Bill, with the main focus of dissent coming from London.
Most notable to me were the fact that the police, under the powers of this legislation, and this is new, will be able to say that this demonstration, for example, through the noise that it's causing, is causing a nuisance. And if that nuisance is serious, they will be able to arrest people, fine them up to £10,000, and imprison them.
What will be next? That bill comes through, that's just going to be one of a whole range of new policies and things that would just silence any form of criticism.
The new legislation pending in Parliament could allow police to impose conditions on protests, including start and finish times and the imposition of noise limits. This bill would also allow the police to prematurely end a protest if it caused serious annoyance to the surrounding community, organisation and businesses, which demonstrators argue is the whole point of protests.
This bill makes it impossible to have any kind of strike, any kind of picket that has any effect.
Thousands upon thousands have turned up here to defend the right to protest, something Brits up and down the country feel is under threat.
More than 600 civil society and protest groups have called for the government to drop the legislation, and the mobilisation of protesters on the streets has already forced a planned passage through Parliament to be delayed. Yet only time will tell whether the huge protests up and down the country has successfully defeated the anti-protest bill. Ahmed Cabello, London.
Over 300 marches took place and hundreds of thousands demonstrated all over France for May Day to claim more rights for the workers. The COVID crisis is hitting the French economy very hard, but not everybody is equally affected by the crisis. The 40 biggest French companies are doing very well despite the COVID crisis, but they prefer to pay benefits for their shareholders rather than improving working conditions. So the main concern for French trade unions now is to save jobs and to stop companies from firing workers.
The big companies have received a lot of public money without any social ecological conditions to fulfill. Public money cannot be given to companies that fire workers, continue to pollute, companies that relocate. So we demand that strict conditions be imposed before giving public aid to companies.
The COVID crisis has highlighted the importance of ordinary workers for the French economy. Garbage collectors, railway workers, supermarket cashiers, mostly women, home care workers, delivery drivers, and, of course, hospital workers. Their work is now widely considered as essential to keep the economy running. French President Macron promised to re-evaluate their jobs.
Macron just promised a bonus that is not even obligatory. He does not want to increase the minimum wage, and that is for us to reference. The government thinks that the higher salaries will lead to less jobs, but for us it's the opposite. Higher salaries will boost the economy and create more jobs.
The demonstration in Paris was closely monitored by the police. Clashes broke out when more radical demonstrators threw stones and bottles to the police officers who charged and fired tear gas. There is a lot of frustration among working people. Many blame the French authorities for its disengagement from the public sector, especially the hospital sector, which is crucial to get the coronavirus under control. The anger is still growing among working people. Those at the front line against the coronavirus demand a permanent upgrade of their jobs, salary and working conditions. But the French government, till now, has only paid them bonuses once. Chris Den Hunt, Paris.
Across the world, and even in the United States, people took to the streets to celebrate International Workers' Day, May 1st. The turbulent 2020 saw America reverse 50 years of political apathy. Marchers say the time for the lower and middle classes to unite is now, because the 1% is already united and profiting from soaring post-lockdown inequalities every day.
I do think that there will be a rise of leftism because, you know, when we're able to win certain gains through struggles like Black Lives Matter has, you know, getting Chauvin convicted, that shows the power of the working class to fight for more. And, this is just the beginning of the mobilizations I think we're going to see.
Given the status of Chicago as the ideological center of neoliberal thought, many may be surprised that the epicenter of the very first May Day ever was Chicago. In 1886, 100,000 Chicagoan leftists peacefully took to the streets to demand an 8-hour working day and were met with deadly police violence. The U.S. government failed to replace May Day with an attempt at Law and Order Day, but by 1890, the first International Workers' Day for Unity and Solidarity was declared. The holiday is celebrated in scores of countries and often called Labor Day, but most English-language countries celebrate their own Labor Day in autumn.
This is a day where we're connecting lots of struggles that are important to the workers' movement, right? Immigrants' rights, the defunding the police, the Black Lives Matter explosion of the last year, right? The uprising has shown that there is really a fighting mood within the U.S., the workers' movement in general.
Many 19th-century struggles are still being fought today, such as against the privileges and parasitism created by monarchies. New U.S. President Joe Biden just rejected a $15 per hour minimum wage, even though wages haven't been hiked since 2009, and non-governmental estimates of inflation are 10% annually. Businesses like Amazon are dubbed innovation heroes in the mainstream media, yet are notorious for grueling working conditions. Many marching on May Day also oppose Western liberal democracy, which is often accused of creating and protecting a new aristocracy on the backs of the average worker. Ramin Mazahiri, Chicago.
Another Joint Commission meeting among the remaining signatories of the Iran nuclear deal, the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, the JCPOA, comes to an end in Vienna. Iranian lead delegate Deputy Foreign Minister Abbas Araghchi says an agreement has been reached to remove the majority of individuals and entities on the U.S. sanctions list and that negotiations are continuing on the rest of the names on the list. Araghchi had mentioned earlier that the U.S. has also agreed to lift sanctions on Iran's energy, finance, insurance, automotive and shipping sectors. But Iran is demanding the removal of all U.S. sanctions imposed after the U.S. withdrawal from the deal in 2018, including those imposed under other labels by the Trump administration.
It's a very complicated issue, and as you know, sanctions have different categories, and we have to deal with all of them. Of course, what is our guiding principle is the positions the firm positions taken by the Islamic Republic of Iran and has been emphasized by the Supreme Leader.
Iran has also steadfastly opposed a step-by-step process, saying it would only go back to full compliance after all U.S. sanctions are lifted and the Islamic Republic verifies their effective removal. Arakshi said delegates are now involved in the time-consuming process of drafting an agreement.
Now we have some texts available to us based on the negotiations we have already made, and now we are working on the words and phrases and sentences and paragraphs.
EU coordinator Enrique Mora said there were moderate advances, adding that with more detail comes more complexity. While the US delegation led by Robert Malley has been engaged in negotiations in Vienna, there's been no direct talks between Iran and the US. Delegates have decided to have further consultations in their respective capitals before returning for another joint commission session here at the end of next week. Homa Lezgi, Vienna.
Thousands of Palestinians took to the streets in the Gaza Strip after the Friday prayers in solidarity with Jerusalem al-Quds and its people. The Hamas movement organized a mass rally. The protesters slammed the acts of violence done by Israeli forces in Jerusalem al-Quds and expressed solidarity with Palestinians in the occupied territories.
Jerusalem al-Quds has always been our main cause of conflict and the destination of all the resistance and revolutions. We will not accept the Israeli regime's attempts to Judaize al-Quds by expelling and killing its people and demolishing their houses. Al-Quds is known for its brave men and women.
We are here to stress on our support to protesters in Jerusalem al-Quds and Al-Aqsa Mosque and to tell them that we are here feeling what they feel and we will be all gathered to liberate Palestine and Jerusalem al-Quds. I call on the international community to stand by our people in Al-Aqsa and support them against the inhumane Israeli regime.
The mass rally in Gaza, which occurred for a second Friday in a row, was triggered by Israeli restrictions on Palestinian worshippers in Al-Aqsa Mosque and the regime's crackdown on protesters against the restrictions. The protesters in the Gaza Strip vowed not to remain silent to the Israeli aggression against their brothers and sisters.
This is a message to our people in Jerusalem al-Quds that we will keep supporting and defending you against the Israeli occupation. We won't sit idle until seeing Al-Aqsa free and raising the flags of Palestine in al-Quds. We are all united on the road of resistance against this occupation.
Palestinians consider resistance as the only way to respond to all Israeli violations and a key to liberating the occupied Palestinian territory.
In the middle of the holy month of Ramadan, the historic Jama Mosque in Srinagar, the capital city of Indian-administered Kashmir, wears a deserted look. So are the other religious places across the region. Amid rapid surge in COVID cases, the religious bodies here have suspended congregational prayers and other religious gatherings.
We should understand the present situation. We request everyone to offer prayers at home instead of going to mosques. In this holy month, let's all pray for those affected by this virus and for an end to the pandemic.
Authorities in Kashmir have imposed lockdown to curb a surge in COVID infections and deaths. The announcement to impose lockdown came after the region recorded 700% increase in active COVID infections in this month alone, sending the alarm bells ringing. Officials have already banned gathering of more than four people, but essential services have been exempted from the lockdown. Authorities claim that there is no shortage of oxygen, medicines and COVID vaccine in the region, saying the government is handling the COVID situation effectively. But some people blame authorities for their late response to the pandemic.
There was no robust system of testing at the airport, at the Srinagar airport. And the biggest problem in our case was that the government and the administration here threw open Tulip Garden and organized other Khelo programs, mass gatherings, fashion shows. So this was to showcase normalcy. And in the process, what happened, that that from 50 odd cases per day, now we are here where we have more than 3,000 cases on a daily basis, and there are 30 plus deaths.
India, the world's second most populous nation, remains in deep crisis as hospitals and morgues are overwhelmed by the pandemic, with medicine and oxygen in short supply and strict limits on movement imposed in the country's largest cities.
The second wave of COVID-19 pandemic is causing a steep rise in the number of infections and posing a huge challenge for health experts and the government here. Experts have warned that the fight against the pandemic is far from over and have urged the people not to drop their guard against the deadly virus. Say the least of Indian administered Kashmir.
Palestinian refugees and Lebanese factions have held several gatherings in solidarity with Jerusalem al-Quds. Lebanese political representatives denounced the Israeli aggressive practices, both in the occupied territories and the besieged Gaza Strip.
So we are here today to say to the world, and to especially to the Arab people, not the Arab leaders, that they should unite and stand against what's happening. They should be united against the crimes against humanity we are seeing. Innocent people are being bombarded every day. Innocent kids and people are being killed every day, and nobody's lifting a finger.
Palestinian factions stress that as long as Palestinians are able to protect their historic right to their homeland, then there is no fear that Israel or any collaborators can steal it away.
The battle for Al-Quds is a battle on behalf of the entire nation, so the least we can do is to give support to this intifada. This is an extension of several uprisings since 2015 and until today. The occupation forces want to grasp control over the Al-Aqsa Mosque and its surroundings. Palestinian protesters need support, and today we tell them that the Al-Quds is not alone. We saw the support from the West Bank and Gaza to Al-Quds, which shows that Jerusalem Al-Quds won't be left alone.
The speech is noted that all the resistance factions, whether in Lebanon or Palestine, and the entire resistance bloc, united stands with the Palestinian people in their fight for freedom and life.
Your steadfastness is a humiliation to the occupation. We stand with you every single day, and soon we will liberate Palestine.
I tell our brothers in Al-Quds that God is with you, and this means no one can defeat you. I tell all the people of Palestine, hold on, victory is near. You're the rightful owners of this land.
Protests and confrontations broke out in occupied Jerusalem Al-Quds after Israeli authorities decided to break a pledge of respecting the right to worship by forcing their way into Al-Aqsa Mosque's four minarets in order to silence the evening call to prayers. The Israeli violence has evoked anger across the Arab and Muslim worlds.
A salute to Jerusalem al-Quds and the steadfastness of the Palestinian people in the Holy Land is what Lebanese and Palestinian activists have gathered for today. And despite all blockades and Israeli aggressive policies, they stress that the younger generations will resist more than ever before. Maryam Saleh, Beirut.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily round the clock for listeners across the globe. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran can be heard via internet, shortwave, medium wave, FM, and satellites. Our listeners in Indian subcontinent can listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave, 41 meters, 7,410 kilohertz, every day from 1520 to 1620 UTC. Also, our listeners in Europe can tune in to English service of the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave, 31 meters, 9,855 kilohertz, and in Southern Africa via shortwave, 31 meters, 9,835 kilohertz every day from 1920 to 2020 UTC. Our listeners in Tehran can also listen to our program via FM 91.5 megahertz. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and IranSat, or BAT 5, and via internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program P.O. Box 19395-6767 Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about audio quality and other means. Thank you.
In the limelight.
For decades, U.S. military operations have been contaminating the Pacific region with toxic substances, including plutonium dioxin and VX nerve agent, says John Mitchell, the investigative reporter for Okinawa Times. In this regard, we have prepared an article for you written by Tim Sharrock, writer. This article is published under the heading Toxic Legacy of U.S. Military in Pacific. Stay tuned for more. John Mitchell, the investigative reporter for Okinawa Times, has spent years documenting the Pentagon's brazen use of the Pacific as a testing site and dumping ground for dangerous weapons. Wherever the United States military goes, it contaminates and damages the environment and human health, he says. He warns that the proposed U.S. military expansion in the Asia-Pacific, its largest since the Vietnam War, will aggravate an environmental disaster caused by 75 years of American wars and intervention. The Pacific Islands have been militarized since the Second World War by the American military and are now the edge of the American Empire, he said. They suffered in the past and will inevitably suffer in the future. Mitchell's recent book, Poisoning the Pacific, the U.S. Military's Secret Dumping of Plutonium, Chemical Weapons, and Agent Orange, explores this largely unknown legacy. Based on hundreds of declassified U.S. documents obtained under the Freedom of Information Act and interviews with U.S. veterans and whistleblowers, it documents the Pentagon's use, testing, and storage of chemical, nuclear, and other weapons of mass destruction, WMD, in the Pacific, and the disastrous impact of its flawed handling and storage of such weapons. For decades, U.S. military operations have been contaminating the Pacific region with toxic substances, including plutonium dioxin and VX nerve agent, Mitchell explains in his introduction. Hundreds of thousands of service members, their families, and residents have been exposed, but the United States has hidden the damage and refused to help victims, he added. The dangerous lurch toward military confrontation in Asia underscores Mitchell's concerns. The U.S. Indo-Pacific Command recently unveiled to Congress that it is seeking $27 billion in additional spending to station additional troops and weapons to counter what it claims is a growing military threat from China. The plans, which also draw on $4.6 billion appropriated by Congress for its Pacific Deterrence Initiative, include a precision strike missile network on the island chain running from Okinawa to the Philippines, the first U.S. Marine base in the Pacific since the Korean War, a missile defense system on Guam, and a radar system on Palau in the Marshall Islands. The Pentagon is also seeking funds to reorganize the 27,000 Marines based in the Pacific region into small units into Guam, Japan, and Hawaii that can operate inside the range of Chinese rockets. The harm that could follow from this expansion can be seen in Okinawa, the focus of much of Mitchell's book. It houses 70% of the total number of U.S. bases in Japan, where 50,000 American troops make up the Pentagon's largest overseas contingent. Through his tenacious reporting, Mitchell has uncovered story after story about the use and misuse of WMDs on the island prefecture, which was occupied by the U.S. military after the bloody battle for Okinawa in 1945 and handed back to Japan in 1972. In 2011, Mitchell was the first reporter to interview U.S. Air Force technicians on Okinawa in charge of the storage of nuclear weapons, which included over 1,200 warheads at Kadena and Naha Air Force bases as well as at U.S. Army ammunition dumps in Chibana and Hanoko. He also broke stories about the U.S. testing of biological weapons and its storage and transshipment of Agent Orange, the defoliant used over Vietnam on Okinawa. His reporting extends beyond the Cold War. Mitchell uncovered the U.S. military's accidental use of depleted uranium rounds at an Okinawan live fire range in 1995 and 1996, its dump of radioactive waste into sewers beneath U.S. bases in mainland Japan in 2011, and hundreds of recent environmental accidents at U.S. bases on Okinawa that were not reported to Japanese authorities. His book also describes years of high decibel noise pollution from the American jets flying near residential areas in Okinawa. Such long-term exposure is a serious health risk that can cause heart problems, disrupt sleep patterns, and damage cognitive skills in children. One Japanese university study estimated that noise from Kadena was responsible for an average of 10 deaths a year, with 17,000 people suffering from disrupted sleep. The U.S. military presence on Okinawa is an environmental justice problem. That's what the American people must understand, Mitchell said. Earlier this month, the importance of U.S. bases to America's Pacific strategy was underscored when Japan's Prime Minister Yoshihide Suga was the first foreign leader to meet with President Joe Biden at the White House. In a joint statement, the two leaders affirmed their ironclad support for the U.S.-Japan military alliance and agreed that Japan would complete construction of a new U.S. Marine Air Base at Hanoko in northern Okinawa as the only solution to replace the unpopular Futenma facility. But, as Mitchell points out, the U.S. military is building the Hanoko base, the scene of daily demonstrations upon a pristine coral reef. Their environment has been decimated by the American military, he said. The Pentagon, through U.S. Forces Japan, denies most of Mitchell's claims. The statement that the U.S. does not clean up contaminants is simply false, a U.S. FJ public affairs officer wrote in a lengthy email. The GOJ, that is, the government of Japan, has never indicated to the U.S. in any bilateral forum that the Okinawan environment has been decimated. The American response to environmental spills is some of the most aggressive in the world, the PA officer added. The health and safety of everyone in and around U.S. installations is one of our top priorities, and we take matters of environmental stewardship very seriously. Mitchell has also reported extensively on water pollution on U.S. bases. During 1960s, he said the water near Kadena was so contaminated that it literally could be set on fire. In his book, he documents 650 environmental incidents between 1998 and 2016 at Kadena, largely caused by leaks of fuel and firefighting foam. These incidents have ranged from small fuel leaks of only several liters that stayed on the base to large spills discharging tens of thousands of liters of fuel and raw sewage into local rivers, he writes. Military incompetence has repeatedly endangered local water. More recently, Mitchell documented severe water contamination in drinking wells around Yokota Air Base, the headquarters of U.S. Forces Japan, near Tokyo, where American presidents and other senior U.S. officials land when they visit Japan. In 2000, officials from the Tokyo Metropolitan Government found no evidence the pollutants came from inside the base. But Mitchell argues that Japanese government reports carry little weight, because its officials are prohibited from entering U.S. bases to carry out inspections. The problem, he contends, is the U.S.-Japan Status of Forces Agreement signed in 1960. Thanks to this agreement, the American military does not need to clean up contaminated land, he said. They do not need to allow Japanese officials to inspect the bases. In contrast, in the United States, you can go to EPA webpages and find out what bases are contaminated with what. Asked about the SOFA clause that prevents Japanese officials from inspecting U.S. bases, USFJ responded with a qualifier. While the basic language of SOFA has not changed since its inspection, it said both of the U.S. and Japanese governments agree that the agreement works well to serve the interests of the two countries. In the end, concluded, the commander of U.S. Forces Japan is designated as DOD lead environmental component for Japan and therefore will ensure U.S. military operations are carried out in a responsible manner that will protect the environment now and for future generations. Statements like that, along with the lack of U.S. press coverage, reflect the disdain on the part of the American elite towards Okinawa, Mitchell said. Most American newspapers don't report about these daily injustices to the people of Okinawa. They don't report about the contamination. They don't report about the weapons of mass destruction. To make the situation worse, the American military has dismissed the testimony of servicemen, saying they're mistaken or were lying, he said. So documents are vital.
Debate. What country's foreign policy is determined by the higher echelons of the political ladder, possibly all the way to the top, and not by the foreign ministry of the country? That was one of the points that Iran's leader made in his most recent speech. This was in reference to some derogatory remarks that were leaked in an audio file which went against the views held on Iran's foreign policy. The good force of the country's Islamic Revolution Guards Corps, the IRGC, and the force's martyred commander, Lieutenant General Qasem Soleimani. That's the subject of this edition of The Debate. Let me introduce our guest, university professor and political analyst Fuad Izadi joins us. We also have political analyst Sayed Mostafa Khoshesh, who also joins us. Welcome to you both, gentlemen. Fuad Izadi, let me first start with you. First of all, tell us what prompted Iran's leader to make the comments that he made in his most recent speech. What was the content of his speech on that matter? But first, what prompted him to actually make those comments, you think?
Well, obviously, the leader is not happy with the tape that was leaked. Of course, as you know, the foreign minister says that this was a private tape. It was not supposed to be publicized or published. But saying these things is something that it's basically contrary to Iran's constitution. We have in Article 176 of the constitution that the system of making policy on foreign issues, foreign policy issues, or security issues is laid out. And Iran's National Security Council has 12 members. The foreign minister is a member of Iran's National Security Council and has one vote out of 12. So the suggestion that every time the foreign policy of the country should be in line with what the foreign minister thinks is not really based on Iran's constitution. And as far as I know, in no other country you have a situation where the foreign minister makes all foreign policy decisions. Generally, in many countries, you have a setup like the National Security Council, and the country's president or head of the government or head of the country, and the councils that exist at higher levels engage in policy making, and the foreign ministry is supposed to implement the policies, and so asking more than that would be a little too much. And the remarks generally were not welcomed. Even Iran's president, who appointed Iran's foreign minister, was critical of what he heard. And then we had the speech yesterday that was basically saying that a mistake was made in making these remarks, and that's what Ayatollah Khamenei said.
Okay, we're not after, I guess, vilification of the foreign minister, but in this case, Mostafa Khoshesh, looking at how Iran's leader has come out, and as our guest there described, for example, how the foreign ministry, in terms of the institution itself, what role it plays, and there were some other matters also. Can you please give us your synopsis of what Iran's leader has said on those matters?
Hello, Kavin. Thanks for having me. Well, foreign policy, not just in Iran, but anywhere in the world, foreign policy objectives are set and achieved as a product of power, the power that's generated by the country in various sectors, in all areas, in soft areas, in semi-hard and hard areas. That is to say, in soft areas like theater, cinema, books, culture, art, as well as media, especially media power and media outlets play a contributing share in this regard. Also in semi-hard areas like economy plays a very important and vital role in advancing your foreign policy agenda and achieving its goals. Like when the U.S. failed to subdue Iran through military means and avoided that, they went after sanctions as and political and economic actually leverage in order to contain Iran's power, Iran's growing power in the region, and the missile industry, and the nuclear industry, and Iran's overall power. So they used the economic leverage, and they are still using it. And also in hard areas, the military also plays a significant role in generating power. All these areas, all the power that the country can generate helps you achieve your foreign policy agenda. Therefore, all people responsible or officials and sectors responsible for these areas, they should also contribute a role when you describe your foreign policy agenda and goals. And in this, the foreign minister also plays a role. He, no matter it's Zarif or anyone else, he also contributes a share when designing and describing and producing this foreign policy agenda of your country. But he is not the only one. Sometimes his role is bigger than others, sometimes it's smaller. And the foreign ministry actually is tasked with, as Dr. Izadi said, is tasked with implementing the agenda mainly, and the foreign policy, the official in charge, Mr. Zarif, and the foreign minister actually, is one of the team that decide the foreign policy agenda of the country. If you know how to play in this team, then you may advance your country's foreign policy agenda. If sometimes you miscalculate, then you might be in trouble and the country would be in trouble. Now, as Mr. Zarif played a bigger role in the JCPOA, in the nuclear deal, when designing this strategy or policy, he had a smaller role in the region. Why? Because the United States, the forefront of the United States in this Middle East region or West Asia region, comes from its military. The U.S. CENTCOM has the first and the last say in this region on behalf of the U.S., although it's not very clearly on the surface, it's not involved anymore in this region. It shouldn't be, actually, after the two wars in this region, and ever since the militants started the war in this region, they called for a coalition against ISIL. But actually, that proxy warfare was the result of the U.S. hidden agenda. Yes, covertly, they were involved, but covertly, they were not actually to be in this part of the war. Still, you hear a lot from the CENTCOM commander, General McKenzie, and it's 10 times more than the statements and remarks made by U.S. ambassadors to the Persian Gulf Arab states or other Arab states in this region, the Middle East states. There is the reason for that, because the main role on behalf of the U.S. is played in this region by their military. Therefore, as they have targeted Iran in this region, Iran's military should also be in the forefront, and it should be the first and main player in this area. But in the outside world, when it comes to Europe or Far East, you could see that Zarif is on the forefront very naturally.
All right, well, let's break that open, Fuadizadeh, if I may ask you to do that for us, because there were references made to the Quds Force of the Islamic Revolution Guards Corps. Tell us what the Quds Force is, and tell us the role that it has played in terms of policies that have been exercised, especially in the West Asia region.
Well, Quds Force is a branch of the Islamic Republic Guards Corps, and it's a military unit that is charged with engaging outside Iran's border generally. When the threats, when the problem, for example, in Syria, when we had ISIS, the Syrian government asked Iran for help, it was the Quds Force that was present there. When we had a similar problem in Iraq, it was the Quds Force that went to Iraq. So this is what Quds Force does. What General Soleimani did was also he engaged in political issues that dealt with security matters in this part of the world. And he became very good at it. I was watching a webinar by a U.S. Senator, Chris Murphy, the other day. This is a webinar that happened last week, and he was saying that General Soleimani was the most powerful man in the Middle East, which is actually true. So because of what General Soleimani was able to do, the Quds Force was more than just a military force. So he engaged in diplomacy, he met with politicians. In fact, when he went to Iraq on the night that he was assassinated, he was supposed to meet with Iraq's prime minister the next day. So in the recent years in Islamic Republic's foreign policy, regional issues, things that deal with Iran's neighbors, are generally the task of the Quds Force, whether it is military related or even diplomatic issues are generally the domain of the Quds Force. And then the foreign ministry has other tasks. For example, the nuclear talks is something that General Soleimani was not very much a part of. It was Dr. Zarif and the foreign ministry individuals that dealt with that portfolio. So the way the system of foreign policy making in Iran works is that after a decision is made in the National Security Council, then an entity gets that profile and is the lead organization for that profile. So JCPOA, it was the foreign ministry, regional issues, generally the Quds Force, and they are basically helping each other when it comes to achieving foreign policy goals. And one reason Dr. Zarif's comments were criticized was that some people seem to feel that he thought that there's a competition between the two, which is something that's detrimental to a country's foreign policy when different parts of an entity start competing with each other, and that's why people criticize what he said.
Do you agree with that? If I can ask you that similar style of question in terms of how the different branches of the country need to work in unison with each other and not feel like they should be in competition with each other?
Yeah, definitely. As I said earlier, foreign policy agenda and achieving its goals could only happen as a result of interaction among different branches of power and different bodies in a state within a team. That's why at the Supreme National Security Council, you have representatives of not just the foreign ministry, but you also have representatives from the economic sector, the guy in charge of budget and planning organization is there and has a vote, and also from the security sector, the military sector, from the political sector, from different, and also heads of branches of power, head of the judiciary, head of the parliament, head of the government, actually President Rouhani, the president of the country, heads the National Security Council of the country. So it's a team, and all the time they should work with each other. In some specific geographies, because of developments like the Middle East, where military developments have left a great impact on anything, everything in this region, one of the team members should be upfront and others should help. And vice versa. In some others, you need to work on your foreign relations and diplomacy, then others would help you. This is decided, actually, in this team, and it should be practiced by everyone. Therefore, there shouldn't be any kind of competition. I do believe that what Mr. Zarif was talking about is that there is a standard for the support that others would render to one of these team members. And that level standard is decided by the Supreme National Security Council and the leader, and especially the SNSC. And what Zarif wanted was more than what has been already decided by the team. Like, let me give you an example. After the JCPOA, a dozen U.S. Marines trespassed Iranian waters on two boats, and they were arrested by the IRGC Navy forces based on international rules and regulations and according to the Constitution and the right of self-defense, and their duty is to do so exactly. But after they captured these Americans, because Mr. Zarif requested, they released these American trespassers after a few days. And if it hadn't been for Mr. Zarif and the JCPOA, I believe they would have been kept in Iran for years, I mean, those Marines. So I believe Iran has already, I mean, the other team members have already rendered enough help to the foreign ministry. You know, you shouldn't sacrifice your powers, like your military power in this region, in the Middle East, for the sake of interest in another part of the world. And that should never be expected. It's not a one-man show. This is the problem, I think, that should be resolved. It's not just about Mrs. Zarif. It should be understood by anyone who wants to go and head the foreign ministry. It doesn't make any difference. We need to understand this, that it's not a one-man show. It's a team, and you should be part of the team. And you should never try to be, you know, more radiant than others, if I may put that this way. Anyway, I believe that Mrs. Zarif is now thinking more about it. It's a technical issue, I believe, and it has happened, and it's nothing, you know. When such a thing happens in other countries, they either continue the work and they do the apology and they deal with it through expert views and discussions, or if it's very, you know, troublesome, then they resign. It's nothing specific. If you see that it's talked about and discussed so much internally within the country, because it's an election issue, actually. It's a partisan issue, and we are approaching the election season, so it's right. Discussed under much discussion. But outside, because the Americans want to make something out of it in order to discourage Iranians and say that if the JCPOA has proved to be a failure already, it's not because of the right. Americans defying the sanctions, it's because of you yourself.
Okay. Well, in conclusion, let me ask you, if I may, Fuadizadeh. So we're looking at a region in which Iran has proven itself to be a major force. I believe that there's no denying that, because it's pretty much echoed all over the place from the West, the Western countries, to you name it. How would you assess the way that Iran has executed itself in terms of not only the region but the world, but in particular, obviously, the West Asia region where it's located?
And, you know, Iran's foreign policy is affected severely by what happened in Iran in 1979, the Islamic Revolution. And when you read Iran's constitution, you see this desire by the people who wrote the constitution to make sure that the principles of Islam are implemented, whether it's domestic policy or international policy. So there is this duty for the country to engage in activities that are dictated by the teachings of Islam. This is what Ayatollah Khamenei is tasked with. He's the leader of the country. He's supposed to make sure that the country's constitution is fully implemented. And this is why he objected to what he heard in that tape, because it seemed that some of these objectives in terms of Iran's regional policy is not fully understood or believed by the country's foreign minister.
Okay.
And so this is the issue that Iran has been dealing with, and Iran continues to grow in the last 40 years and learn from the past mistakes and hopefully improve on its policy in the future.
Very well. Thank you very much for that. We do appreciate it, Fuadizadeh, university professor and political analyst. And Sayyid Mustafa Khoshesh, thank you so much, political analyst. That brings us to an end for this edition of The Debate. From Mikhail Tatway, entire team in the Capital.